Welcome to Series 15, Episode 2 of York Hospital Ball. This week's guest is John Williams, aka The Flying Postman. John's career path was an unusual one, catching the eye playing for Cradley Town before Swansea City took a chance on him. As well as being top scorer in his debut season at Swansea, he was also named the fastest footballer in Britain, having won the Rumbelows Sprint Challenge at Wembley. John's rise continued when he signed for Premier League side Coventry City, and his career saw him ply his trade up and down the country with various clubs, which of course included York City, whom he signed for in 1999. Here, John talks about his highs and lows from his career in the game. This episode is sponsored by longtime sponsors, the Nearly Departed app for iPhone. If you travel by train, you need Nearly Departed. Whether you're traveling to work or to an away game next season in League 2, Nearly Departed will help you get there by showing live updates for your train service. The app has been carefully made by a York City supporter and is available for free in the Apple App Store. So download Nearly Departed today, ready for when you next travel by train. But for now, here is Series 15, Episode 2 with John Williams.
So, John Williams, thank you so much for giving up your time to speak to us on York Hospital Ball. It's a York City podcast, but obviously you achieved so much in your career before arriving at Boven Crescent, a career that was defined by the flying postman and raw pace. And so I wondered about your sort of early interest in football. Was it always football for you growing up, or was there like an opportunity in athletics because you were that quick?
To be quite honest, Dan, athletics, I was not the fastest kid in my area. I think there was far more quicker people within the area that I lived in all around the region. So it was very competitive. I think I sort of gained a lot of pace in my older years after I hit 20. So I didn't realise how fast I was, because I thought I lived in a society where everyone was fast, so no one was fast. So then, to my amazement, when I, you know, people used to tell me how quick I was, I used to just think that was normal.
And you were age 22, I think, when Swansea picked you up. So you'd sort of come through a bit of a different route to the sort of traditional academy system. So did you feel like a professional football career had passed you by at that point?
Not at all, because I didn't even think that I'd become a professional footballer. In the eyes of myself, I went and played for a non-league team called Cradley Town, and they sort of put a team together that was, like, I like to class it as a bunch of misfits. And we had a keeper that was quite exceptional. We used to call him the Wall, and you know, nothing used to get past him. He made it as a pro later on in himself, and you know, unfortunately, he passed away. Rest in peace. His name was Alan Nichols, and I think Peter Shilton took him under his wing at Plymouth, and he died in 1995 at a very young age. And that was a bit of a shock to, you know, the football world and to everyone who knew him. The other side of it was there was John Ford, Andy McFarland, and I think there was a few others who made professional careers. But yeah, for me to say I was going to be a professional was, you know, the last thing. All I knew was I was quite old. I was working and getting paid for playing football part-time, and that was far as I looked.
And so how did the sort of move to Swansea come about then? Were you having a few scouts from different teams coming to watch you? Sounds like there was obviously a few in your Cradley Town team that were being watched, maybe.
Oh, definitely. There's a lad who was scoring. He was phenomenal. He was scoring all the goals, but little did they realise that the person who was on the right wing was putting all the chances for him on the plate, myself. And the lad, he must have scored 20 goals in about 10 games. He was phenomenal. And I think Portsmouth came and bought him for £10,000. And, you know, when they realised he was there, they tried to change his game, and he weren't happy with the way they tried to make him a target man when he was purely just an out-and-out striker that could make goals, score goals. He wasn't great in the air. He was just, you know, he was just unique in his own way. Yeah, so we played quite a few teams in pre-season. We played Stoke, Birmingham and Swansea, and for a team of misfits, we really give, you know, these professionals a hard time. And I think on the back of that, I think Frank Burrows must have got the sack and went to Swansea, and he brought a team down in the summer, and we battered them.
So it kind of came from there then, and they just started open talks with you, I suppose. So when you signed for Swansea, what was that step up like? Because no one likes playing against pace, but did you find that even though you were jumping several leagues, that your speed sort of helped you immediately in that sort of division?
Well, to be quite honest, Dan, when I first got there, I wasn't used to regular training. The first month, for 2 weeks, 3 weeks for me was an absolute nightmare. I was getting a tone to regular training and playing games, and my calves were constantly solid. So half the time after training, I couldn't walk because I wasn't used. I was, you know, just as I said, I was getting a tone to the training every day, and my body was adjusting. And very first time I got there, Frank Burrows said to me, "Oh, you're starting on Saturday." And I was, as you said, I was very raw, enthusiastic. I was hungry. I was aggressive. And all I wanted to do was play football. And, you know, I had this sort of excitement and enthusiasm about me to say, you know, I want to push myself against players at a high level and see how well I do against them. So that was all the incentive and motivation that I actually need was a challenge.
Yeah, and you obviously made that adjustment pretty well, because I was researching some of the games that you played in that 1991-92 season, and you made the step up look fairly seamless, because you scored a hat-trick in what sounded like an absolute crazy game at Bradford yeah. City, where you won 6-4. What do you remember about that game?
The thing that I remember about that game, there was three long balls over the top. I closed and chased them down and scored nearly every time. Like you said, it was a really crazy game. I mean, I think I watched it on YouTube and it was a bit crackly because it was that long ago. But I remember that game with fond memories, and it sort of enhanced my abilities as someone who could get in behind and chase lost causes. And fortunately for me, I scored three great goals on that day, and 10 goals in a match is, you know, great for the fans and the spectators.
Yeah, and I think I was reading as well at the time that, you know, Swansea were struggling away from home as well. I don't know if it was like your first away win of the season or something like that, but to get it in a 6-4 win at Bradford City is pretty mad, really.
I mean, the atmosphere is electric. Bradford, you know, I've always carried a big following and a big crowd. We went up there. We was on a bit of a run at the time. I think we got team of the week. And, you know, for me to score that hat-trick, it goes down. I think it was my very first league hat-trick, and I was very happy about it.
Can imagine. And obviously, most people remember you around that time for being labelled the fastest player in Britain, because you won the Rumbler Sprint Challenge, which I understood was fought up by sort of Saint and Greavesy, and the club's nominated players up and down the country, and there were heats as well, and everyone ran in a full kit. So how did that kind of come onto your radar? At what point did you realise that you were going to be in this competition?
To be quite honest, Dan, this is Frank Burrows again being inventive and the genius that he is. Most clubs around the country had races where they pitted all the players against each other, and Frank Burrows just said, "There's no point in me doing that. You're going to go and you're going to win." And that's all he said.
When you sort of did it, you clocked 11.49 seconds, and not bad for someone who was supposedly hungover as well. I think I read that you'd been out the night before, you'd scored against Darlington, I think. And I also noticed as well that you sort of had a standing start compared to all the others, but I didn't know if that was down to the hangover or just your kind of preference of how to set off.
Oh, I think this story has been told several times in the last few months, Dan, to be honest. But yeah, if I would have gone down on my haunches and done a sprint pose, I would not have got up. So yes, it was down to the hangover and down to the drink that I had to stay. And if you can see, I was rocking. And as the gun's gone off, I've rocked backwards, but everyone else is propelled forwards. And the only thing that was focusing my head, if I could catch him on halfway, 50 yards, I will pull away because I get quicker as I go on. And fortunately for me, that exact thing happened.
What was it like with the crowd? Because obviously it was before a League Cup final as well, wasn't it, I think?
Yeah, Nottingham Forest played Man United. Roy Keane, I think, was his last game for Notts Forest. And I think it wasn't really a great game. I knew Man United beat him, if I'm right. After winning the race, I wasn't really watching the game. I think John Ford, my close friend who came with me on the day, he was up in the restaurant, you know, having meals and, you know, watching the game. But to be quite honest, I can't really remember the game. I was just so elated, the fact that I won £10,000. I never ever won that type of money in my entire life. I mean, I didn't even get paid that much money annually. So
yeah,
it was good.
And that was my next sort of question, really. I put that, you know, you won £10,000 on a new TV, and having scored the day before against Darlington as well, were you kind of pinching yourself, given that a year earlier you were kind of delivering mail somewhere? And, you know, it's obviously turning pro a little bit later in your career. It must be different sort of feeling to someone who's come through the academy route and broken into the team.
Oh, most definitely. I mean, some of the lads, like for me, they helped me along in a massive way. They were very helpful and supportive, and they made me feel welcome. I was a long way from home. I was from a different type of background from some of these lads. And, you know, the fact that I made professional, it was everybody's dream. I pinch myself every day, so to speak, metaphorically. And I felt like I didn't want this roller coaster, this dream to ever end. So I embraced it and enjoyed every moment I played a game. I played as if it was my last game. So that gave me the sort of motivation to play well. I think I ended up top goal scorer that season. And I think towards the end of the season, as I said, I won that sprint race, and it sort of pushed me to prominence where a lot of people sort of were recognising me for the attributes that I had. And yeah, it was the best feeling in the world, being a professional footballer.
Yeah, and that sort of brings me on quite nicely to the next one as well. Like, I wondered whether the flying postman and winning the Rumbler Sprint Challenge. Sort of, did that sort of follow you around, and did it change how defenders were starting to treat you? Like,
it's followed me around still to this day, to be honest. My email address as well is the flying postman. I think I sent that to you. I'm not sure.
Yeah. I'd had a chuckle.
Yeah, the name is stuck. And as I said, I can go anywhere. And, you know, the people always fondly remember me as, oh, yeah, you're the postman. And that name is sort of stuck simply because of, you know, what Sainton Greavesy and John McCririck and, you know, mainly Alan Parry did in that run.
And you scored 11 goals that season. You said you were top scorer. And you know, some great goals as well. I found another one that you scored against Brentford that was really impressive. And did you know that Coventry were interested at that point? Were there other clubs? And I kind of wondered second to that, did Coventry feel right given it was sort of back in the Midlands for you?
To be quite honest, Dan, like as I said, it was, for me, it was just a total, I lived in a dream for 12 months. And the fact that I was given a challenge to play football, I was pushed into a position to score goals and make goals. And I played on the wing and I played up front and in different games. And I really enjoyed my time. I think I scored quite a few goals in the Welsh Cup as well, but they were not counted because it was separate from the league. I ended up being the top goal scorer that season. And I think the game that stood out for me was when Bobby Gould was the manager of West Brom. They were highly tipped for promotion. They had some big name players on big wages. And literally, like, for me, it was a homecoming. I lived literally 2 miles down the road from West Brom. And in my heart and in my head, I'm not going to lie, I felt like, you know, how could you let two lads who are on your doorstep go all the way to South Wales to play football? Your scouting network must be awful. So for me, I just wanted to sort of stamp my authority and show them what they missed out on. And that's what happened. John Ford was with me by my side. I think we were losing 2-0 at half time. And I think there's three long balls over the top. I made a hat-trick for our substitute, Steve Thornber. I think that's when I was cemented in Bobby Gould's mind as someone who was just a nuisance and a constant threat.
And Bobby Gould, he was a real character, wasn't he? Like, obviously managed a crazy gang as well, Wimbledon. And what was he like to play for, I wondered?
As I said, everyone else, totally different how they view managers. And, you know, everyone gets treated differently by managers. But he was absolutely fantastic for me. You know, he believed in me. He gave me confidence and belief. And he trusted me, so he knew how to get the best out of me simply because he'd done his own work on me. He found out about my character as a person and what I like, my likes and dislikes. And, you know, as a modern day manager, he knew how to get the best out of his players. And I wanted to play for someone like that, you know, and I had his trust. And yeah, I was a bit devastated when he got the sack or when he left. But those, the years under Bobby Gould, I classed as the years that I could have really, really, really excelled as a professional. And the fact when he left, it kind of stopped. My progression kind of halted.
Yeah. And just sort of rewinding slightly, you know, you made history as well, didn't you? You scored the Coventry's first ever Premier League goal, but also nearly made history because you scored the second quickest Premier League goal just 4 minutes after Brian Dean scored for Sheffield United, I think. Did it feel like a big moment at the time? Did you think the Premier League has become so huge since then, hasn't it? But when you signed for Coventry, did you think about the sort of magnitude of the Premier League and what it would become?
I've watched football my whole life, Dan, and all I thought was some of these players I've seen on TV, these are some of the best players in the world, in the country. And it was a whole new feeling, the level I had to sort of, again, prove myself and challenge myself against these top players. And I think the team, my instructions were drawn to a letter through me from Bobby Gould, what I needed to do. And with the ability and some of the skills that I possessed, I put that into place and I embraced it. And as I said, scoring second fastest goal, I didn't even think about that. All I thought about was we wanted to get 3 points, and we beat Middlesbrough on that day 2-1, and that was the most fantastic feeling.
You scored twice away at Spurs in a 2-0 win and again at home against them a month later. And I think I read somewhere that you were a Spurs fan growing up. So were they sort of like the highlights of your time at Coventry?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, I think Tottenham was a bit of a bogey team for me. Whenever I played against them, I made sure that I stamped my authority, stamped my mark, or I made an impact in some way. Even when I went on loan to Notts County, the time when I was loaned out at Coventry when Bobby Gould was gone, I said to Russell Slade, I said, oh, I know I can't play because I'm cup tied. I was always a bit of a bogey team. I said, I think we're going to win today. And he said, well, I hope so. And then Notts County went and beat him in the cup. It was a great feeling. Well, for them, not for me.
And I just wondered again, you talked about the sort of transition up to the sort of highest division. And again, I wondered what the step up was like in terms of defenders. And, you know, you played a lot of your career, like you say, on the right-hand side. And I was thinking about the left-backs that were playing around that time, particularly someone like Stuart Pearce. They must have been real battles when you were playing people like him.
Yeah, Stuart Pearce was, for me, was one of the England's best ever fullbacks. He had everything: pace, power, tenacity. He could score, he could get forward, he could defend. You know, I had a few comments that were taken out of context when we played them on a Monday night. I think I found myself in the stand in a pile after he put one of his tackles into me. But as I said, I've got a lot of admiration and respect for people like Stuart Pearce. They've done everything, they've won everything, and he's a fine example for any young player or any fullback to have a look on his career and see what a great player and ambassador that he is for the game.
Yeah, and you also scored at home to Man City, I think, in a 4-0 win, and against Leeds in a 3-3 draw that mathematically, I think, secured Premier League survival for Coventry. So looking back, there must have been really, really happy times in your not just your career, but your life, I suppose.
Oh, most definitely. My period at Coventry is where I met some absolutely fantastic lads, all down to earth, really good boys. You know, David Boost, Steve Morgan, Lee Jenkinson, Sean Flynn. You know, we had a mass of players, and also the new regime that the new manager who brought in went on to bigger and better things. And the fact that I played with these players, you know, Mick Quinn was absolutely joy to play with. Roy Wegley was absolutely fantastic. Phil Babb, Peter Atherton, Andy Pearce, you know, Oggy, Brian Burrows for me was shining example of an ultra professional who he always had time for the players, and he always had a word of advice, a bit of confidence. And Kenny Sanson, you know, was one of the best professionals at that club.
And Peter Unlove was there, wasn't he, around the same time as well? And what a player he was.
Oh, he was phenomenal. He was a kid for me that had everything. He was always the first one in and the last one to leave. He's always trying new things, always working hard. He had just a zest for life and a zest for football. He was infectious, and some of the things that he did rubbed off on me, even though he was a little bit younger than I was. But he was a great professional and a good lad to play with.
And I can imagine under Bobby Gould, the dressing room will have been really important as well. When, you know, Coventry were one of the lesser sort of teams in the Premier League, where to survive around that time with some of those teams was a massive achievement, wasn't it? So the dressing room must have been really, really important. You know, and you mentioned some of those sort of characters like Mickey Quinn. So what was it like being in that dressing room?
It was quite phenomenal. All the lads there, it was, you know, Mickey Quinn was always talking about his horses and doing his thing and enjoying his life. And he gave great advice to all the boys. He was ultra professional as well. You know, we had people like Dion Dublin. We had, as I said, the older pros, Lloyd McGrath, Brian Burrows, Oggy, you know, they sort of kept up. And Stuart Robson was there. He was another fantastic player. Robert Rosario. Yeah, the dressing room was, you know, as I said, everybody was, there was a good togetherness, a good team spirit. And, you know, we've done a lot of team building together. We've done a few army camps and, you know, things like that that were a bit unconventional at the time, but we bonded as a team and we fought, and we always knew we were the underdogs. And, you know, we always sort of came together on match days and gave teams a hard time.
And you mentioned there about Bobby Gould leaving. So Phil Neal came in. Was that just a matter of football being football and some managers fancy you as a player, some managers don't? Is that kind of what happened there?
Well, Phil Neal was there from the start. He was the assistant manager, and as I said, he had an ideal of how he wanted football played. And fortunately for me, I wasn't part of his plans or the type of player that he wanted around. So I have no hard feelings. Sometimes that's football. That's the journey that it goes on. If it weren't for him, I wouldn't have been the person that I am today. He made me mentally stronger. He made me tougher. He sent me out on loan 3 times. I have no axe to grind or anything like that, but I'll never forget the fact that he put mental strength in me for the way he treated me. And, you know, at the time I would have looked at it and think I was at my lowest point. I didn't feel great. I had no confidence, but I bounced back and life's okay.
And you bounced back, and you mentioned there a few loan spells, but then you joined Wickham and, you know, scored 15 goals across 2 seasons.
Yeah, I went to Wickham and things didn't start off great. We had a great lad there who was on fire, Miguel de Souza. He was scoring goals right and centre. Yeah. And I said, a lot of the lads were there from the Martin O'Neill era. And, you know, every day you'd hear Martin O'Neill this, Martin O'Neill that. You know, he'd done great things for that club, and he was a massive, and he's an absolutely phenomenal manager. But I never played under him. But his name was mentioned nearly every day at that club. Again, the John Williams curse struck. Alan Smith got the sack. And another manager came in, and I was on my travels again.
Eventually, you did join York City, which is obviously what this podcast is about. But you joined York City from Cardiff, and I just wondered, you'd scored 16 goals for him, and I wondered sort of how you were received at Cardiff, given your sort of Swansea links.
Oh, this is what's quite funny, and you won't believe this. The manager, there was about, at the time, I think Cardiff was struggling financially. It was 98-99 or 99-2000, I weren't sure. I just left Exeter. Frank Burrows gave me a call. This is the manager who started my career, brought me back on loan, and then you know, he took over at Cardiff. And initially, when I got there, there's a few whispers. I'll tell you this story. In Wales, if you leave from Cardiff to Swansea or Swansea vice versa, you're a hated man. It shows you've got no soul in their eyes. And it's just like going from Villa to Blues, Celtic to Rangers. It's something that nobody wants. It happens, but you know, none of the fans want that. There was a few bits of rumbling going around. And I think Frank Burrows always had faith in me. He knew what I was capable of. So he introduced me to the team a little bit slowly. Fortunately for me, the lads started off very slowly. They were struggling for goals. There was a lad who I played up front with who's, you know, I'm going to class as the best strike partner I've ever had, a very close friend of mine. He's now under-21s manager at Millwall, and he's helped me out on and off the pitch. And he's sort of one of the people who have made me the person that I am today, Kevin Nugent. And I think we scored 44 goals between us that season, and we got Cardiff promoted. Kevin was an unbelievable target man, unbelievable character. For me, scoring those goals and getting Cardiff promoted was the first time in my actual career that I actually won promotion, the actual thing that you're in football for. And I was elated. I mean, I had another year left on my contract, got them promoted. We had some talented young players that were coming through, and Robert Earnshaw, it was the phenomenon. When I was there, me and him used to do training together, finishing. You know, he was like, he wanted to absorb and learn everything, skills, finishing, movement, runs. And as I said, he was a privilege and is a very close friend of mine even to this day. Because as I said, when I arrived at Cardiff, he was 17 years old. I think he scored 40 or 50 goals in the youth team. And he was like a baby sponge. All he wanted to do was learn everything. And it shows in his character today. He's warm, he's honest, he's genuine. And as I said, he's a hard-working kid. Players like that, I was privileged to play with. But I was moved on because I was, I think, 31 years old. And the move came about, I think Neil Thompson saw what I could do. He knew I was experienced. He knew I could score goals. He knew I was still lightning quick. And I went up to York. I'm not going to lie, I was a bit reluctant because I just bought a new house in Cardiff. I absolutely loved the way they treated me. The fans, I was a bit of a cult figure. Well, That's what they said I was, but I think they might have spelt it wrong. But yeah, it was a bit of a wrench. I think I've only ever cried twice in my life when I left the club, and it's when I left Swansea and their rivals. So that's how the move came to me. 31 years old, they got me for nothing and sold me and got me off the wage bill and sold me to York. I went up to meet Mr. Thompson, and he sold the club to me well. I can't remember the chairman's name, but he was a judge, wasn't he?
Douglas Craig.
That's him. He had narcolepsy. I'm sure he was asleep when I was talking to him, or maybe I bored him to death. But he was always falling asleep. And when he was in negotiations, he fell asleep and he agreed to what I asked for. And I'm like, I'm sure he didn't hear what I said. I'm sure he was asleep. But he signed it off, and I moved up to a little place in York called Pocklington.
Yeah.
Bought a house there. And the thing that sort of attracted me to York, you know, in and around Bootham, and the whole, it was a beautiful city. The people were very friendly. It was a lovely, the ground was right next to the Roundtree factory, a bit of an old ground, but the fans were quite warm. I mean, you know, there weren't many of them at the time, but Neil Thompson told me what he wanted, what he expected from me, and he never mentioned any of the players that were already there, but they had some very, very talented young players. I think we struggled because we didn't have enough experience or enough players within the squad, and I'll hold my hand up, I really didn't do great for that team. I loved the city. I didn't go without me trying. But towards the end, when certain types of players were, I like to call them labourers, came in, it just felt like it was a bit of a dark cloud hanging over that club. And we were just battling, even when we didn't need to battle. And then again, the John Williams curse struck. Neil Thompson got fired. A certain manager came in, and I think my days were numbered once he walked through that door. And I don't even want to mention his name, to be honest.
You played with Graham Potter, I think. And I just wondered, did you ever see a future manager in him? Because I don't think he was captain of York or anything like that, but did you ever see the sort of leadership qualities that he'd then go on to have?
That's a good question. Potsy was always professional, very quiet. He was sort of one of these people that would get on with everyone but get on with no one. He'd do his thing. He was always respectful, polite. I could honestly say I never, ever seen him being a manager, and he's been absolutely successful in what he's done. Fortunately, in this business, as he's found out, you don't get the time to settle and do what you did. He did a great job at Brighton, that got him a move to Chelsea and got paid up from Chelsea. And then he ended up at West Ham, got paid up at West Ham, and now he's got another job at Sweden. Yeah, I remember the club he was at, Östersunds. We moved a player over there and they could not sing his praises. They thought so highly of him. And, you know, I just thought, hearing those things about a lad that I played with, who was very quiet, kept himself to himself. He wouldn't upset. And he had certain lads he went round with who he played golf with. But yeah, Potsy was a brummy like myself. To say that I know anything about him was, he was very aloof. I didn't expect him to be a manager and be as successful as he is, but I'm very pleased for him. He's a lovely man.
Well, let's rewind a little bit, because I think your debut was away at Torquay, and then we got beat 3-0 at home to Rochdale, and then we got beat 6-3 in a game at Barnet. And I just wondered, what were you thinking? Because you just got, like you say, you just got promoted with Cardiff the year before. Probably the bigger achievement, other than getting promoted with Cardiff, was actually winning their fans over the fact you played for Swansea. And then you've come to York, you've been sold this kind of, not a dream, but you've been sold something by Neil Thompson. But were you thinking after those early defeats, were you thinking, this isn't what I signed up for?
I looked at the squad and I saw some talent in the team. You know, Barry Conlon, there was Scott Jordan, Matt Hocking, the Foxy.
Christian Fox.
Bullock, Chris Fairclough. And there's a Jones.
Barry Jones.
He was honest, hardworking, and he had Chris Fairclough next to him. And we had, is it Jinnah?
Yeah, Wayne Hall.
Lovely kid, great player. Rodney Rowe was there. So, yeah, as I said, for me, they had a mix of youth and experience. But for some reason, it just wasn't gelling and the results weren't coming in. It was very direct. It was very, as I said, I couldn't really click. And I did play some decent games, but for me, I wasn't scoring enough goals.
York only scored 39 league goals that whole season that you were there, and they used 35 players. Was that part of a problem, really? You mentioned quite a few good players there that you played alongside, but do you think it was that many players being in the squad and rotated that was the problem?
For me, there wasn't very many talented players who would create chances. It was like you're always battling, always up against it. You didn't have players who would create many chances. It's hard to explain. It just didn't click when I was there, and I couldn't really put my finger on it. You know, if I could apologise for the fans, I'd actually apologise. You know, they never saw the best of me. They probably saw glimpses of brilliance or something, a wonderful pass or little bits and pieces, but they didn't see the full repertoire of me. And that was one of my low points and one of the things that I was disappointed about.
Yeah, you did score some goals for your, you know, a crucial one against Hartlepool at home. 2-1 win in March, which I think sort of went a long way to helping us survive. But do you feel like it wasn't enough in terms of your own sort of expectations and sort of high standards, really?
Yeah, definitely. I can't even remember one goal I scored for York. That's how suppressed and low I must have felt at that point. Not playing for York or being in the city, the fact that I really don't remember. And it's weird. I remember most of the goals I've scored. I remember Barry Conlon's goal against Shrewsbury. That was one of the best goals I've ever seen. We had a green kit on and he scored this goal. It was unbelievable. So you said I scored against Hartlepool. For the life of me, if you could send me that goal, I'd love to see it.
I
cannot remember for the life of me. When the manager sort of lost his job, I partly felt responsible, but that's the game that we play. You know, you either do well at certain places or you don't. And for me, York, everything was set up there. I was settled. I moved to the area. The fans, as I said, they were very patient with me, and I did not have any ill feeling or bad thoughts about that club until a certain person came in that door and used his smokescreen and treated people. I mean, I remember one game we played Stoke City in a Carabao Cup. We played them at Bootham Crescent and they battered us 5-0. The next week, all the players that he dropped were in the stand. He sent us all to Stoke away. And this is the one thing that I actually remember. We absolutely battered them, annihilated them football-wise. We came off the pitch, it was 0-0. Okay, the game was already run from the first leg. Nigel Pearson came up to me after the game and he said to me, "Where were all you lot in the first leg? If you are all capable of doing that, why didn't your manager see that?" And I couldn't answer him. I shrugged my shoulders. Colin Alside, he was with me. Matt Hocking played. Chris Fairclough, is because the game was already lost, so he put us all in. Yes, Terry Dolan went on and sort of kept the club up. But for me, said I couldn't be around someone like that. The games he played and the things, the way he treated a lot of the lads, I just thought, I think I was one of the highest paid players there. And for me, I wasn't on great money through my whole career, but I think York was probably one of the clubs that I was on, the highest wage that I was on.
Probably because Douglas Craig was asleep when he told him what you wanted.
So he paid it came to an arrangement where I had my contract terminated and, you know, they paid me up. And then I moved on to another crazy chairman, George Reynolds.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. This guy. I actually wasn't this. I've never been in shock in my whole career, in my whole life, than sitting in a boardroom or a room with this man who was sat on a chaise longue in a cravat getting fed grapes by one of his people. And I thought, I've only ever seen this in Cleopatra. What is he doing?
Because this isn't that, you know, it's not that long after you're playing in the Premier League for Coventry. So it must have been quite surreal, really, having a chairman like Douglas Craig falling asleep and then having George Reynolds with that. It must have, like you were saying, you were pinching yourself earlier in your career, but you must have been pinching yourself for a different reason this time.
Well, to be quite honest, my career, it was quite short, but I had longevity within the spans of my career, as in I was still going, but I still had belief. I met some great lads. Glenn Naylor, a couple of them played for York. There's a centre-back, Craig something, and he was assistant manager at Middlesbrough.
Little, maybe?
That's him. Score headers, great bloke. They had some really good players. I'll tell you who, the manager of Preston, Heckingbottom. Great lad, good player. Bernard, who was at Newcastle, he was on loan. Andy Collette, great guy. I went there and, as I said, in my head, I was just moving further and further up north, but I was still based in York. So I went to Darlington. And for me, it was the feeling of uncertainty. It felt like I was coming to the end. And again, at Darlington, I really didn't perform great. I scored some important goals, but I didn't feel like I scored enough. And I said, like, going with George Reynolds, the fact that I got my contract paid up from York, he actually thought he was doing me a favour by offering me reduced wages. And the fact that if I didn't have the money that York paid me, I wouldn't have signed that contract. I would have gone somewhere else. But I thought, well, I'm up this way. I've got to wait for my house to sell. I'm going to come and play some more football and hopefully put myself in the shop window. Fortunately, it didn't work out that way. But I've moved on from Darlington at the end of the season. You know, I met a great bunch of lads. I think I'm in touch with a couple of them.
Because you had a good record against Darlington, didn't you? Because you mentioned earlier about scoring for Swansea before the day before the sprint final. And I think one of your goals for York City as well was against away at Darlington as well.
Yeah, I remember.
Must have made a good impression.
So I think that, because Gary Bennett was a manager and, Gary was a great guy. Got a lot of time for Gary. But as I said, for me, it wasn't somewhere that I really wanted to be. I just felt like being a lad from a big city and, you know, I seemed to be getting further and further away from where I felt comfortable.
Yeah.
And then the weirdest thing was, I think I became like 31, 32 or 33 even. I took the kids to America and to Disney World. And, oh, I kid you not, I just thought, this is the end of the road for me. I don't think I'm going to get anything after this. So I've gone back home now, got back from America. There's a voicemail on my phone. I'm like, who the hell? Very upbeat, very excited. Come down and see me. I want to negotiate a contract. I've got something for you. With John Hollins. I was like, wow, okay. So I've gone back down to Swansea now, signed a 2-year deal. I was slightly portly. Don't laugh. Gallen signed for Swansea. I got injured on the first day in pre-season because I was slightly out of condition because I didn't think I was getting anything. Mm. So, you know, I should have kept my mindset and kept myself. It becomes a drain when you get so many knockbacks and so many managers that sign you, get the sack, and you know the inevitability that it's always a striker's their target, or, you know, they want to bring their own players in and their own strikers, and you're not the striker, the type of striker that they want. And that was my career. But I never, ever not believed that I was any good. I did not believe that I could not score goals. I always believed I had a use because I was gifted with speed.
Mm.
So
You rarely had injuries, did you? I was looking through your career. You know, you played a lot of games, so you clearly never had a sort of bad injury that, you know, you see players who have one bad injury and then their pace is gone. Do you know what I mean? Or they lose half a yard, but you never really seem to have that.
No, I didn't. I had weak muscles in my back. And if I'd have known now, if I knew then what I know now, I'd have done a lot of core. My back used to snap out of place. So I used to think my hamstring was gone. And then, you know, I'd go back in the dressing room. The physio would click me into. I realised I had leg length discrepancy. So I was always out of line. My hamstring used to go. And then second half, I'd come out and I'd be all right again after the physio's treatment. But yeah, I was very fortunate not to to sort of pick up really any serious injury. I did pick up a serious injury when I was 41, 42, playing in the Masters when I retired, but that was due to wear and tear. Leaving Darlington and going back to Swansea was a massive thing. There's a little bit, there's a few people that was a bit upset, you know, like you said, the Swansea.
I was going to say, how difficult were you returning here, or were you kind of, yeah, treated a little bit differently because of the Cardiff link?
Yeah, it was. There was certain rumblings. So there's one game where I came back from injury and I was playing against Exeter, another one of my old clubs. I think I scored two. So I took my shirt off because I lost a bit of weight and I stuck my fingers up to the bloke that was swearing at me and got myself into a little bit of bother. But the fact that that's how I overturned the fans and got them back on side, that was sort of when we found Mamadi Sidibe. He came and he, again, another great lad. He came, he turned up at Swansea with a carrier bag full of clothes and that, from France, and that's all he had. To the point where I said to him one day, I said, oh, John Ollie's put him in digs. And he said to me, oh, have you got a suit to wear? He went, no, I don't. So I gave him one of my suits. And I think to this day, he still has that suit. I saw him at Stoke a couple of years ago. And he went, John Williams, he said, that suit that you gave me, I still have it. I says, it's my Hugo Boss one, can I have it back? But he says, you're a good man, a good person. I'll never forget what you did for me. And sort of that made me feel quite proud and happy that the fact that someone remembered a good deed that I did for them. Well, back onto the Swansea thing, that the fans, they knew that I loved that club. I've been there twice before. And it was like, as you said, it was a homecoming for me. Third time I was there. And in the time I was there, we had a changing of three managers. In fact, probably four. John Hollins, Nick Cusack and Roger Freestone. Colin, whatever his name was. Oh, what's his name again?
Addison.
I didn't want to mention his name. Him. And then Brian Flynn came in. Brian Flynn.
That is the John Williams curse, though, isn't it? And somewhat four managers in a season.
Yeah, but that's the way my career went. So people think, oh, why do you keep moving clubs? Well, I'm not here to sit on the bench and watch everyone else play. If somebody else wants me and I'm talented enough to be signed by someone else and I'm going to play games, that's what I'm in football for. I'm not in football to pick wages up and pick my money up and not play and watch everyone else, you know, play. I want to do the job that I'm being paid for. And unfortunately, that's the character and that's the person that I am. And as I said, if you look at the clubs that I've had, the reason that you just mentioned is the reason why I had to leave.
Yeah.
Every single time, nearly every club I've been to, change of manager. And you're not going to be everybody's flavour. I owe no ill feeling or towards any manager. Some of them, I won't even mention their names. They know what I feel about them because they targeted me and treated me the way they treated me because that's the characters and people that they are. If they'd have said to me, look, straight away, you're not for me, I'm not interested in you, I'd have had more respect for them. But it was the games that they played and the things they did. I had time for that. So I left. I went to Hereford from Wickham. I went to Darlington from York. And I went to Kidderminster from Swansea after fighting off four managers who didn't sign me.
You rolled back the years with Kidderminster, didn't you? Oh, I mean, the FA Cup goal against Wolves.
Yeah. And,
you know, Premier League Wolves as well. I wonder what that experience was like, because I think you were playing without a contract at that time. But then did you sort of appreciate it more because you are coming towards the end of your career and you're showing, again, what you can do at the highest level?
Yeah, well, brilliant, because I think Ian Britton signed me and he said to me, listen, we can't offer you, we ain't got any money, but I can offer you a non-contract. I mean, when I got in there, I don't know what it was. I always played against Matty Elliott from Leicester in pre-season. Every single time, wherever club I went to, I always seemed to play against him. And he used to turn around and say, oh, not you again. And I says, Matt, I'm really sorry. I said, I'm struggling. I need to get a contract. Any chance of, like, not trying to smash me? Ian Britton said to me, listen, you'll be a great acquisition for our team. They had Bo Henriksen up front, who was scoring goals left, right and centre. They had Sean Flynn, Craig Hinton, Stampsey, Dean Bennett, who was phenomenal, Dean Keats. We had some really, really good players at the club. Matt Gadsby, God rest his soul, what a talent he was. A young lad, come from Warsaw. I was with him at Warsaw and he was in the youth team then, but he came as a man to Kidderminster Harriers and fortunately he passed away, God rest his soul. So playing on a non-contract for me, it was like swimming without a life jacket, sink or swim. So what happened? The John Williams curse. Ian Britton got the sack. I scored a couple of goals for him. I didn't score many. Ian Britton got the sack. Jan Mulby came in. I played against Jan when he was at Liverpool for Coventry, and he was just straight, honest. He took me for what I was. He kept me on. He said, you know, I want you out. You can stay. You're a great lad. You've got a good attitude. I'm going to need you in the up and coming weeks. I said, that's no problem. So it comes to the point where he signs Jesper Christiansen up front as a foil for Bo, two Danish lads. Jürgen Christiansen, a big, powerful, strong unit. And he was a fellow Danishman. So I was on the bench in that game. Him and Bo sort of wore him down. 74th, 75th minute, Jan, he was such a character. He said to me, go and make a name for yourself. And he sort of chuckled and winked. He said, all right, Gaffer, no problem. So I've got on the pitch. I think it was first touch, actually, off a corner. Michael Oakes was in goal for Wolves. Was at Villa. I just touched, swiveled and put it in the bottom corner. The whole ground erupted. All the players jumped on me. And like you said, scoring against Wolves, who were like a massive, massive club at the time. They were in the Premier League. I think it was Dave Jones, the manager, or someone else.
Yeah, I think it was. And I think Alex Ray scored really late on, didn't
he? Alex Ray scored in the 89th minute, like a wonder goal. Historically, this is what it happened yesterday. A lot of teams underestimate all these lower league teams and play weakened teams against them and get battered. They did that with us and got a scare. So when we went back to Molineux, they played their strongest team. And Kenny, the striker, I thought he was offside. I was on the bench again because after scoring that goal, I thought, I thought it was going to be my swan song. And I thought he'd say, right, go on, I'm going to start you. But I didn't. I came on at Wolves and I never started. And we got beat 2-0. I think I played in a couple of other league games. I played the last game of the season. And you know, when the writing's on the wall, I'll tell you a funny story. After the Wolves game that I scored that goal, one of the reporters said to me, oh, John, surely after all your heroics and all the things that you've done, Jan Mulby's going to give you a contract. Kidding me, I was going to get a contract. I says, well, to be quite honest, I said, he quoted that Jan said that he was going to give open negotiations with me. I turned around and I said, a verbal contract is not worth the paper it's written on. I was 36 at the time. I knew I wasn't going to get one. But I have so much respect for Jan, who was totally honest, totally genuine. He was the sort of manager that you'd live and die for. And I've got a lot of respect for that guy. But he never said it to me. And I think the fact that I was 36, they used my age against me rather than me retiring. And I was happy for the time that we spent and for the memories of scoring that goal.
And sort of looking at your memories of some of the grounds that the teams you played for as well, I was thinking like Boven Crescent, the Vetch obviously with Swansea, Highfield Road and Feetham's with Darlington. I mean, a lot of these grounds are just not there anymore, are they? So it must be quite sad really that you can't go back and sort of, I know you go back to Coventry, but obviously they're at a new stadium now, aren't they?
It's not the same feel. All these clubs have got, it's all like a business now where there's a shopping centre or a shopping mall nearby and train links and bus links and everything is a business within a business that circulates around the club. Before it was, you know, you're back in Swansea, the Vetch Field was next to a prison, an armoury. I mean, don't quote me on this, but if there's any place for a terrorist attack, that would be it. You know, right next to an armoury and a prison, a football ground, right in the middle of all three of them. It's such an atmosphere, such a great feeling. Ninian Park, exactly the same. You know, you're right in the cusp of a council estate, dingy little alleyways, and just the feeling of, you know, going across from the park into the stadium was one of the best feelings ever. Walking through the little back streets of Highfield Road, you know, the place where they said, oh, it's the inner city, be careful around here. You know, I remember one day Bobby Gould had us all in our boots as the day we played Villa. We had to walk down to the bottom of the road in the frost and back to the ground in our boots. I'll never, ever forget the things that we had to do in those times. I have fond memories of football. I love football. I even basically do a lot of work for charity now, for Swansea, for Coventry, even for Cardiff. When I've called back, I go and play for the lads who are sort of passed on and, you know, to help them for their causes. And that's what it's about for me.
And a lot of those grounds as well were very, I felt they were a lot closer to the pitch as well, the sort of crowd. So, you know, you playing on the right wing for a lot of your career, you must have heard all sorts of stuff shouted at you, sort of good and bad.
Oh, I definitely do, yeah. I mean, part and parcel of the game. If I was there to sort of focus on the fans, I would never have had the career that I had. I would have probably been in there rowing and arguing with people, and everyone's got their favourite type of player. When I was at the Vetch Field, I was the first time I was there, I was a bit of a, as I said, I was an icon, I was a cult figure. I was lightning quick. The fans took to me when I used to score, and they used to rush down in waves. The hair on the back of my neck used to stand up, and I used to just think, this is the best feeling ever. You know, I'm so elated. These fans have embraced me and took me under their wing. wing. And I'll never forget the first goal I ever scored against Reading when that actually happened. I froze. I was that afraid. I thought they were going to jump over the fence and lift me above their shoulders. But, you know, the North Bank, greatest place, greatest feeling.
And many players sort of, you know, I've interviewed a lot of players over the years, and some of them struggle with life after football because it's all they've ever known. I suppose that transition might have been a bit easy for you, having worked before you turned professional. So what was it like sort of coming out of the game?
I started late. I was working since I was 16 years old. I started in factories when I was at college, and my original thing, I didn't even think about being a footballer. I always wanted to be an electrician. I wanted to have a trade, but unfortunately for me, important people in my life passed away, and I had to sort of survive and, you know, get menial jobs and get myself through college, but it didn't happen. So then I became a postman and got well paid and played part-time football. And that's how the journey went, all the way through to the fact that today, now, I've always had a work ethic. I've never been afraid of working. I work with underprivileged kids and kids in care. And I'm also still in the football industry. I work for a company called Paramount Sports Management. The owner is a very good friend of mine, and he played in the World Cup for Jamaica as well, Darrell Powell. He's opened a few children's home, and he's given a lot of back to the community, and he's doing some great things. And, you know, it's such a privilege to work with someone like that, and an honour, to be honest. And that's sort of the field that I'm in.
And 452 games, I think 72 Football League goals, a career where you really kind of had boots, will travel. Of the sort of 22 clubs that you played for, where it felt like home, where were you happiest in football?
Swansea, Coventry, Cardiff, Kidderminster.
Just sort of finishing off, but best opponent in your career, best teammate in your career that you've played alongside?
Oh, wow. Best opponent would have to be Eric Cantona. Unbelievable. Played against him twice in the same season, I think. He played for Leeds United, and then he moved to Man United. Played against him when he was at Leeds, and we drew 3-3 with them at Leeds, and then he moved to Man United and they beat us 1-0. And the things that he brought to the game, his mercurial, his enigma, he was different class. Top player. It was great to watch. And to be on the same pitch as him was a massive privilege for me. I felt like every club I was at, I had to make a point or prove something to myself. Some clubs felt like Marmite to me. They either loved me or they hated me. So probably some of the memories that I've had are not similar to some of the fans I've had, because at the time the teams are sort of on a downward spiral. So you're always fighting relegation rather than going for promotion.
Just very, very last question then before I let you go. Who was your best ever teammate then that you've ever played with, or strike partner that you've ever had?
Kevin Nugent, top. Glenn Naylor, enjoyed playing with him. Mick Quinn, fantastic. Unlove, Dean Bennett, Kidderminster. But to top them all, Kevin Nugent, Cardiff City. He was a joy to play with. He made loads of my goals and I returned the compliment. It was like we had a bit of a bromance. It was great. Great to play with someone like that. We appreciated you for your talent and it was reciprocated. It was good.
Well, John, I know we haven't been able to talk loads about York City because you've suppressed a lot of it. And, you know, I think a lot of the supporters probably have, but it's been great to speak to you about your career. Very iconic player of the 90s, of the era that I kind of grew up in. So thank you for giving up your time, and hope you've enjoyed kind of talking about those memories.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it, Dan. Thank you.
So thank you for listening. Hope you enjoyed that. A little bit of a departure from the normal interviews, which are meant to be a celebration of York City's kind of history. John clearly didn't enjoy his time at York City, but I thought that made for a really interesting kind of insight, to be honest. It was a time period that we wouldn't ordinarily cover, because it was a time when York City didn't score a lot of goals and didn't have a lot of confidence. Probably the total opposite to what they're doing now. So, yeah, appreciate John being open and honest about his time at the club. But, you know, I also found it fascinating his, you know, his rise in football, and a little bit like Ian Blackston, Tony Cannon and people like that, you know, not always having a traditional academy route. I always think it makes for a really interesting story. So I hope you found the same thing listening to that. This is part of Series 15. So we started off with Kingsley James, but that was obviously a couple of months ago. And now it's probably the first series I've done where I'm doing it as and when I can kind of get contacts. I've got another one who's just agreed to come on, which hopefully I can put together in the next couple of weeks and get a new episode out. So that's kind of how it's going to be over the summer. So please do sort of subscribe if you can, so then you'll know when the new episodes drop. They're not going to be as kind of scheduled as they've been in the past. Also, just want to say a massive thank you to anyone who listened to the Matt Oogler interview. That was
think it was about 2,500 of you at the time of me recording this have listened to that episode, which is absolutely phenomenal. And just a reminder that you can win a signed shirt by Mark Kitchen, just go to justgiving.com/yourcosportalradio. You can donate any amount, just make sure you stick your name on it. We're going to keep that going until the end of May and do a little draw for that, and then I'll hand it to someone during a pre-season game. Or if you live away from York, you can still enter. I'll post it to you. So absolutely no catch. You can literally donate £1 if you wanted to. It all makes a big difference to York Hospital Radio. We're a charity that have been going for over 60 years now, and we appreciate all the donations that we get. And then just finally, other ways you can help, please do keep giving us 5-star reviews if you can. I think we're up to 87 now, so if we can get to 100 on Spotify, that would be great for the algorithms. So please do, if you listen on Spotify and you haven't rated us before, give us a good rating at the top there, write us a review, that's really helpful. But just keep spreading the word, and like I've always said, every time we do a new series, there's always someone who hasn't quite discovered it before, whether it's because they don't listen to podcasts or whether they've just not realised there's York City ones out there, and there are a few of them now. So yeah, please do keep spreading the word. All the York City content is greatly received by everyone who puts stuff together, so thank you.